Good morning, Alaska. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your co-host, Prentice Pemberton. Well, throughout history, unimaginable atrocities have been perpetrated by humans on other humans. How is it possible, with our incredible ability to reason and our huge capacity for compassion and love, that our history is littered with examples of one group of people trying to exterminate another through the rape, slaughter, torture, and mutilation of innocent men, women, and children? Oftentimes, those doing the slaughtering were once neighbors or co-workers caught up in a firestorm of dehumanization and bloodlust. On today's program, I'm joined by philosophy professor and author Dr. David Livingstone Smith. Dr. Livingstone Smith has researched and written extensively on the subjects of war, human cruelty, and genocide, and was a guest at the G20 Economic Summit in 2012, where he spoke about dehumanization and mass violence. Welcome to the show, Dr. Livingstone Smith. I appreciate you taking the time to join me today.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate you inviting me.
All right. Before we get going on our topic, I want to remind folks that we are a call-in show. For the next hour, we are going to look at the ability humans have for cruelty and how the practice of dehumanizing others is a key ingredient for creating an environment where mass atrocities can take place. If you have a question or a comment about today's topic, we'd love to hear from you. You can call us locally at 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Or you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. All right. Let's start off with the theory around dehumanization, and that it is the essential element in creating an environment in which genocide can kind of take hold and grow. You started studying dehumanization. You thought that seems like an interesting topic. It's probably been studied a lot before. What did you discover when you started researching for this book?
Well, one of the things I discovered, surprisingly, is that it hasn't been studied a lot. That the literature on dehumanization is confined almost entirely to social psychology. And that has only been since around the year 1999. So there's not a large literature at all here. And the research literature is not very varied. So there hasn't been attempts to, at least before my book, to pull together information from diverse fields to try and develop a big picture of dehumanization. So when I started investigating this, I was, like I said, shocked that although the word dehumanization is thrown around a lot,
all the time,
there's not a great deal of scholarly literature. And people mean very, very different things by the term. So semantically, it's all over the place. And it was very important to me to kind of focus a bit, try and decide what I think dehumanization best refers to, and then to try and make sense of it, try and make sense of it in terms of the psychological forces involved primarily. But not exclusively, because when we're looking at dehumanization, we're obviously human minds have to be capable of dehumanizing others, by which I mean thinking of them as subhuman beings. So there is a psychology involved there very importantly, but also politics and culture, these forces outside the human mind that get us to think of our fellow human beings in really terrible and dangerous ways.
When you when we're talking about dehumanization, I assume you had to sort of define it. What are the characteristics for your work that I guess sort of identify for somebody who's just kind of tuning in? What does dehumanization mean?
Context. Good. So here's how I understand dehumanization. Very simple, very specific. When we dehumanize others, we conceive of them as subhuman creatures. And that, there's a lot to unpack there. I mean, first of all, there's an obvious puzzle. So if you're dehumanizing another human being, that other human being is outwardly indistinguishable from any human being, right? So, you know, if you have a bunch of committed SS officers, and this is Nazi Germany, and they're looking at a Jew, they think of this Jew as an Untermensch, as a subhuman. But of course, this Jew speaks German and stands on two legs and wears clothes and protects himself from the rain with an umbrella and takes the streetcar to work and all of these characteristically.
And has children and expresses love and
all
fear.
Those things.
Right.
Yes, that's
all
right.
All human traits. Hmm.
So dehumanization, when we dehumanize others, there's got to be something else going on than how they appear. And to understand that, what I did was to go to a body of psychological research which pertains to what's called psychological essentialism. The idea here is that what makes a kind of a being the kind of being that it is something inside, something not observable, but that's supposed to be responsible for the observable characteristics. And that gets called the essence. Now, this is not good science at all. There aren't essences
of like
organisms.
It's like a gut feeling, right?
Exactly right. It's a psychological propensity to think that way. Here's a really good example. If we look at Roman Catholicism, the host and wine are supposed to be the body and blood of Christ. So when you're taking communion, you're consuming the body of Christ and the blood of Christ. But those don't look, well, I guess red wine looks a little bit like blood, but the little wafer doesn't look like human flesh. And in Catholic doctrine, the way this is understood is that, well, they might appear to be a wafer and wine, but they have the essence that is what they really, really are beyond appearances. Are the body of Christ and the blood of Christ. Well, this is how Nazis can look at Jews and think, yeah, they look human outwardly, but inwardly, where it really matters, they're more like vermin or monsters.
And that language is important, an important piece of dehumanization, as you refer to again and again in the book when you talk about Rwanda and Bosnia mm-hmm. and racial strife and mm-hmm. us against them and the American Indians. And I mean, the list goes on and on. But those terms like infestation, swarming yeah. across our borders would be one example. So dogs, the Palestinians, you mentioned a Palestinian nursery where the Jews are our dogs and, you know, mm-hmm. we will, I forget the exact verbiage, but essentially.
Yeah, it was a nursery rhyme.
Yeah, that's teaching
Palestine
children.
Palestine is our country, then Jews are our dogs.
Yes. And
and just to put the other side on that, there are similarly dehumanizing statements from Israelis about Palestinians.
Absolutely. There's similar stories and rhetoric coming from both sides, which creates an environment of hatred and violence.
Yeah.
So that thinking of people or human beings who look like us and share character and we can speak to and we can engage with and have conversations with, but somehow giving them animal characteristics, is that dehumanization, taking away their essence?
Yes, that's part of dehumanization. Actually, the story is a little bit more complicated than the story I told in my 2011 book, Less Than Human. And I'll be describing it more fully in a book I'm working on now, actually, called Making Monsters. Yes,
yeah, that book is, I think, the one actually I stumbled onto initially when I got your name and then came to
and
sought you out, was looking for that book, and you said, well, it's not quite done. So
Not quite.
I grabbed this one, but that one I'm looking forward to. Yeah. So go ahead. Sorry.
So it really extends the story I tell in Less Than Human. So where do I begin? When we attribute the essence of a subhuman creature to another member of our species, what we're saying is really, although they might look human and behave human, deep down on the inside where it counts, they are not human. They're something else. They're like more like rats or like lice or some other unappealing animal, a dangerous animal. You know, they're never cute kittens or butterflies. Why? Because part of dehumanization is that it both releases our inhibitions against committing acts of violence, and it also motivates acts of violence. So it kind of takes your foot off the brake and puts your foot on the gas pedal when it comes to violence. Now, when that happens, in effect, we turn them into monsters. And there's some really interesting reasons for that, which we may get into later as the conversation develops. So subhuman animals, yeah, and that morphs them, not merely into subhuman animals. Because, you know, think of it. We don't think of rats as evil.
Right.
We think of rats as maybe scary. Well, you might like rats. My daughter had pet rats. She liked them very much. Or repulsive, but not evil. But when people are dehumanized as rats, they're thought of as evil.
Dirty.
And more than dirty. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, diseased, a rat is infested. Yeah.
And malevolent. That's really, really important. Malevolent. Nazis thought of Jews as malevolent. Jews were supposed to be out to destroy everything noble and good in civilization. And very generally, genocides have this moralistic character. Everyone who commits a genocide, slight exaggeration, but it's not too much of an exaggeration. Everyone who participates in the commission of a genocide is out to save the world from evil. And so they're not merely rats or not merely lice or not merely wolves. They're monsters. They're demons.
That, if you get that, can wrap your brain around that state of mind, it would explain the ability to commit some of the horrific acts that people commit in times of war.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. We'll get back to that a little bit more, but I do want to go to the phone lines. We have Scott. You're on line one. Go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
First, I'd like to point out that I believe that there are evil people in the world and that those evil people should be dehumanized. And I also believe that there are times where dehumanization can be a good thing. And I'd like to ask that question. Is it possible for dehumanization to be a good thing? An example I would use would be, since the Nazis have been brought up, if you take a farm boy from Ohio, he's 18 years old, he's been raised in church by a mother who says, don't hurt people, be a good young man, by a pastor who has told him the same thing. He is then drafted into the army. He is sent to Normandy, and he is told that he has to kill the Nazis because the Nazis are evil animals, and he is going to save the world.
Right.
The only way that young man is going to be able to do that is if he is convinced that the Nazis are animals and need to be stopped. And I'll listen to your answer on the radio. Thank you.
All right, Scott, that's a good question. I appreciate the call. Go ahead.
Oh, that's a great question, and it brings up a number of different things. First of all, the caller, if you listen, the caller inadvertently contradicted himself in that he said there are evil people in the world,
mm-hmm.
and they should be dehumanized. So if you're an evil person, it's obviously incorrect to think if you're referring to an evil person, it's obviously incorrect to think that they are a non-person, a subhuman animal, right? That those two attributions just can't coexist with one another.
Right, they're just an evil person.
And thinking of evil people in that way is a way, I think, of morally distancing ourselves from them. It's a way of saying they're nothing like us. They're monsters. They're fundamentally different from us. And they're not. Monsters don't exist, right? There are people who perform terrible, terrible acts. But these are still human beings. And we have to acknowledge that if we want to understand the human potential for atrocity. If we lose sight of that, then it's hopeless trying to understand. It just becomes magical explanation. Well, how do we explain these people? Oh, they're just evil. Well, that's not an explanation of anything. That's a moral judgment, and
right.
Moral judgments are fine, but they don't explain anything. With respect to the second element, that's actually really important. Now, historically, just by the way, farm boys from Indiana didn't think of Nazis as animals, unlike how they thought of the Japanese.
Hmm.
And this brings up an important factor, which is that race normally plays a role in dehumanization, that a group of people gets racialized, treated as an alien race, an alien and inferior race, before they're conceived of as subhuman creatures. But your caller does touch on something really, really important, and that is the function of dehumanization. The fact is, human beings don't find it easy to kill other human beings. We get very misleading information on this from the movies where people just shoot each other down and they're all okay with that. In fact, particularly when killing is up close and personal, it's psychologically very hard to do. And the reason for that is we are hypersocial animals. We're extremely, extremely, extremely social. We're attuned to one another. And like any social animal, there have to be powerful inhibitions against lethal conflict within the group. And because we're so smart, we can recognize all of humanity as an extended community. So in order to get ourselves to commit actions like this, we have to have ways of disabling these inhibitions. And your caller was right on the ball there. Dehumanization is one such way. It's not the only way by any means. But it's one very important way of disabling inhibitions against the commission of atrocity. Now, there are my colleague Shannon French and her co-worker, name has slipped my mind from, it'll come back. They've done some really interesting work on this. Shannon is a military ethicist. Tony Jack, neuroscientist and philosopher. That's her co-worker. Sorry,
okay.
Tony. And they distinguish between different forms of dehumanization, which in a combat situation may be more or less toxic. Thinking of enemies as vicious subhuman animals is highly toxic, easily gets out of hand, easily leads to atrocity. But there's another kind of what they call dehumanization, which is using language like considering enemy soldiers targets, say. Or instead of talking about killing, talking about lighting up.
You greased
them. Or taking out.
Whacked them, yeah.
Yeah. That creates a kind of distance, but without the danger of, the same level of danger anyway, of producing atrocity as the more animalistic form of dehumanization does. I don't consider this latter a phenomenon dehumanization. I tend to be a little bit more narrow than that.
Yeah, and there is, there's supposed to be some morality in war, right? Some higher level of treating your enemy.
One of the really hard things in war is to get people to kill without them going berserk.
Without right? anger,
without,
hate.
Yeah. So the problem is once you let the genie out of the bottle, it can lead to awful things. And that's why discipline is, one reason why discipline is so very, very, very important in combat.
Right. Okay. Well, we're going to get into some of the more atrocities and what might cause those. And we do have a caller. We'll go ahead and Paul, you go ahead. You're on line one. We'll have to make it quick because I got a break coming up. Go ahead.
Hello. Thanks for the program. Just a couple of observations. Isn't this a lot like tribalism and the Red Sox-Yankees rivalry, perhaps? Mm. but also goes deeper, such as the Japanese internment, Japanese Americans internment after World War II, start of World War II, and even deeper, our own American involvement, Vietnam and My Lai. And then one local example to me is how we treat mental illness in this country, locking those people off, giving no appeal, calling them liars, I mean, taking away their credibility, making them very much subhuman, and how fear drives all this and how tribalism drives it and how anger drives it, like you've touched on. Thank you very much.
All right. We're going to go ahead and take a short break here because I'm up against it. But then when we come back, Dr. Livingstone Smith, I'd like to have you address Paul's questions because those are some really good points. For anyone who's tuning in late, my guest today is Dr. David Livingstone Smith, who is a professor of philosophy at the University of New England and the author of several books on the topic of war, genocide, dehumanization, and human cruelty. Today, we're discussing his book, Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. After this short break, I'll give you the phone numbers for how you can reach us, and we'll continue our conversation with Dr. David Livingstone Smith. I'm Prentice Pemberton. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your co-host, Prentice Pemberton. For those of you who might be tuning in late, my guest today is philosophy professor and author, Dr. David Livingstone Smith. He's the author of several books on the topic of war, genocide, dehumanization, and human cruelty. Today, we are discussing his book, Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. As always, we welcome your questions or comments, so don't hesitate to call in if you have something you want to add to the discussion. Our local phone number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433, or you can reach us toll-free anywhere you might be listening at 1-888-353-5752, and if you email us at line1@alaskapublic.org, I can read your email on the air. All right, let's get back to I think Scott's question on tribalism. I think which feeds into racism or discrimination and the atrocities that people are capable of committing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it, obviously, dehumanization is related to what gets called tribalism these days, and what psychologists call outgroup biases.
The others, right?
That's right. So there's
us
so
and
the
them.
Basic idea is there's us and them, and they're not. They're no way as good as us. We're way better than them. And there are a bunch of biases that are at work in this kind of division. For instance, the outgroup, the them, are considered pretty much clones of one another, whereas the we is considered to be composed of richly variegated individuals and so on. When something bad happens to them, they deserve it. And when something good happens to them, it's undeserved. And the opposite is true of us anyway. So these are biases.
I mean, that just brings up a point I want to make. Even comments like, you know, when people say, I mean, things like, oh, yeah, they all look alike when you refer to a group or just little throwaway comments are pieces of dehumanization, correct?
I think that falls short of dehumanization.
Okay.
I think it's a nearby phenomenon. So think of it this way. Your caller mentioned sports fans. Well, there might be a certain amount of conflict between Red Sox fans and Yankees fans, but they don't stuff each other in gas chambers, right?
Correct.
It's a much milder thing. So having biases against a group of people falls short of thinking of them as subhuman creatures that need to be either destroyed or enslaved.
Yeah, I was speaking, I guess, to more of the mentality that they are all the same.
Yeah.
They are mm-hmm. different than us. We are unique. We are special. We are chosen.
It's related. Yeah, it's related.
On a continuum.
Just racism is related to dehumanization, too.
A
but
continuum,
you can have racism
yes.
without it. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so back to tribalism, that idea. We are comforted by our own kind. You did such a great job of going back and looking at anthropological research and mm-hmm. biology and psychology, and talked about Erickson and Jane Goodall and the monkeys. And is this evolutionary, this tribalism, is it about safety and security and fear?
The in-group, out-group biases, tribalism.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a sense in which everything is evolutionary. I mean, we're
right.
organisms. We evolved. That question is usually, is it something that was specifically a product of natural selection? And no one knows the answer to that question. And it doesn't really matter, because all that evolution tells us is how traits have spread through a population. It doesn't tell us that they're inevitable or unchangeable, and that it doesn't even tell us how they work. So these are very pervasive biases, but there are certain things when we talk about us and them that we shouldn't take for granted. And that is how the lines get drawn. So
right.
who counts as us and who counts as them? And one of the really interesting things about human beings is we can adjust these lines. So we can embrace groups of people who were formerly enemies. Look at the United States and Germany, although mm-hmm. our president's doing a great job of reestablishing animosity.
He's drawn some lines, yeah.
Yeah. Or we can extrude others that were part of the us into the them. Again, look at the extrusion of German Jews from German societies. German Jews were highly assimilated population. In the 1930s, they were pushed out. They were made other. So what's really crucial is how the line between us and them is drawn and what forces cause those lines to be drawn the way they are. And this is very, very often a function of political propaganda.
Hmm.
Like I said, you know, killing doesn't come easy to us. It takes a lot for most people. And I'm not talking about, there are some people who have no problems killing and harming others, and they don't give a darn about it. But for most of us, it's very, very hard. That's why even in the homicide capitals of the world, really, homicide rates are quite low. What tends to happen is that there are people in positions of power who regard it as advantageous to get us to go out and do really bad things to other people. And they propagandize. They convince us that those aren't human beings. They're monsters. They're beasts. They're going to kill us, they're going to rape, they're going to do awful things, and we've got to save the world by going to war with them. Now, or exterminating them in a genocide. Now, of course, there are people who do terrible things like that. Again, very, very often ginned up by politicians and religious leaders, or just deeply entrenched ideologies in their communities.
This goes back to, I guess, my last radio show where I discussed certainty and conflict. And this goes into this like sense of righteousness or rightness that people have about being chosen or being the special ones. And it seems like when things are okay in the world and everybody's getting along, there's plenty of food, you know, people can coexist. But times of stress or famine or there's a disenfranchised group.
Yeah.
These things can crop up. What makes us politically vulnerable or what makes a society vulnerable from a political perspective?
From a political perspective, right? So let's actually start with the psychology and work towards the politics. We human beings have certain psychological vulnerabilities that are easily manipulated. And it was very, very long ago that people figured out how to manipulate these vulnerabilities. One of them is that it's very easy to racialize other groups. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, to racialize another group is to think of them as fundamentally distinct from us. So in the example of the sports fans, Yankees fans don't think of Red Sox fans as fundamentally different. They think of them as superficially different. They're only different insofar as they support a different team. But when people are racialized, the racial status is supposed to be a fundamental, unchangeable, innate difference. So it's really easy for us to think that way. And that has to do with our tendency to psychological essentialism and our tendency to do something else, which we haven't talked about yet, which is to rank different kinds of beings on a scale, the great chain of being, it used to be called.
Yeah, can you describe that or explain the great chain of being and what the thinking was around that time? Because that's really interesting.
So the great chain of being is a word for a kind of model of the universe. And the official story was that this model of the universe was developed out of some ideas taken from the works of Plato and Aristotle and synthesized in late antiquity. And it's the idea that nature is arranged as a hierarchy, from the least perfect to the most perfect. So the idea was, say, in the Middle Ages, God is at the top of the hierarchy. God is the supremely perfect being, and dirt is at the bottom. And every other kind of thing has a place. Every kind of beings, let's think of plants, various kinds of animals, human beings. We human beings modestly placed ourselves just below the angels because we're supposed to be made in God's image.
Right.
And then when we get around to the 18th century, the human category, the human rank, was divided into sub-ranks, and these were races. Again, Europeans modestly placed themselves at the pinnacle and relegated particularly Africans and Native Americans to the bottom, a hair's breadth away from the subhuman primates. And this kind of scheme was very, very influential. Now, I said the official story is this was synthesized out of ideas from Aristotle and Plato. But I'm pretty sure that's false. It's false because we can look all over the world at various human cultures and we find the same way of thinking. There are higher and lower beings. And the higher being is, the more kind of morally responsive we have to be to it. The lower being is, the more we can treat it as an instrument to satisfy our desires. So we can throw lobsters into pots of boiling water or swat mosquitoes, but we can't, it's impermissible, except out in genocide, by the way, where dehumanization has occurred, to throw babies into pots of boiling water, as happened in the Nanjing massacre,
right,
or to crush human beings. So that's the idea of subhumanity, right? So when we dehumanize others, we kind of think of them as inwardly lower on that scale than the human rank. In the past, this was sometimes described as they're not having souls. So in the United States, it was often, actually, into the 20th century, white Americans, some white Americans, were saying that black Americans did not have souls. They were subhuman beasts. So
souls is what makes us, or gives us our human essence, right? That's what makes us
exactly
different.
It's a stand-in for
the
essence.
Animal. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Nowadays, people often, so the soul was the term of choice, particularly in centuries past. Now, in a more secular age, people say DNA, generally people who know nothing about genetics, by the way. But these are all stand-ins for this very robust idea of a human essence, that which makes us human beings. That suite of propensities, psychological propensities, makes us really vulnerable to propaganda. And that propaganda can politically come about in a range of situations. It might be the ambitions of a ruling elite. It might be conditions of scarcity where people are huddling together and are in competition for very few resources. There are many, many possible scenarios there, so it would be a mistake to think of just one. But what is important is the efforts of some people to get other people to think of their fellow human beings as subhuman creatures that deserve killing.
That is what you refer to as, in your book, a person in authority who is permitting or encouraging.
Encouraging, I would say. Yes. Yes.
Using terms that dehumanize, empowering. Empowering racism, empowering hate speech, that kind of stuff.
Yes. Yeah, terms and also visual imagery. I got into this looking at wartime posters, propaganda posters. Hmm. And I saw how frequently enemies were represented as subhuman creatures visually, as well, of course, verbally. A particularly striking example was a cartoon which appeared in Leatherneck magazine, which was a U.S. Marine Corps magazine.
Right.
Picturing the Japanese people as lice, and talking about the program of extermination that needed to take place. This was the same month as the firebombing of Japanese cities began. And it's really blood-curdling stuff. And this goes way, way back. So, for instance, in the Middle Ages, there was, throughout Europe, but especially in Germany, there was something called the Judensau image. That means Jew pig. Representations of Jews sucking milk from the teats of a sow or inspecting the sow's anus. And there were carvings of this on numerous churches, public buildings, and so on. And it was meant to convey the idea that Jews were filthy, nasty, subhuman others. This continued into the 20th century. I mean, the term Judensau, Jew pig, was used by the Nazis.
It legitimized the hate. It gave a target for the fear. Is that part of what that is to give a blame or a target?
The fear has to be created, right?
Mm-hmm.
In circumstances like this, European Jews were not by any means a challenge to Christian civilization.
Right, they weren't threatening them.
No, a tiny, look, go to the 20th century. The Jewish population in Germany was like 0.5%.
Right.
So there was no objective danger. That fear had to be ginned up by people. And it was. I mean, there were the mass exterminations in the 14th century. And that's, by the way, why so many Jews in the 20th century lived in places like Poland and Belarus, because those who weren't killed in Germany fled east. And this sort of propaganda was key for fomenting this sort of violence.
Why do human beings, why do our cultures and our governments, why do we continue to fall into this trap? I mean, these recent Rwanda, Bosnia, the stuff that's happening all over the world right now is just as horrific as those throughout history, and it's still happening.
Yes.
Why?
Yeah, because it's partially because it's in some people's interest for it to be happening. So the Rwanda genocide didn't come out of the blue. In fact, no genocide ever comes out of the blue.
It builds.
What's been happening in Myanmar, where there's, by the way, a great deal of dehumanization of the Rohingya, didn't come out of the blue. here's where the political forces interact with the psychological propensities to create this really deadly cocktail.
All right, we're going to come back and pick up there in just a few minutes. I want to remind folks, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. We're going to take our 40-minute break right now. My guest today is Dr. David Livingstone Smith, who's the author of several books on the topic of war, genocide, dehumanization, and human cruelty. Today, we are discussing his book, Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. If you have a question or a comment for Dr. Livingstone Smith, please go ahead and email us or give us a call over the next 10 or 15 minutes, and we can get you on the air. Our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433 or reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, the show repeats tonight at 8, so if you're listening to this on Wednesday evening, you'll be hearing a taped recording. We'll not be accepting phone calls. We'll be right back.
Line One, Your Health Connection is supported by a grant from the Alaska Mental Health Trust and listeners like you.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your co-host, Prentice Pemberton. For those of you who might be tuning in late, my guest today is Dr. David Livingstone Smith. He's the author of several books on the topic of war, genocide, dehumanization, and human cruelty. Today, we're taking a look at one of those books, Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. If you have a question or a comment, as always, you can reach us in three ways. You can call us at 550-8433, toll free 1-888-353-5752, or you can email us your questions at line1@alaskapublic.org. All right. I guess this would be an appropriate point to go to our phone call, because the question is, how do we combat it? So, Lisa, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Hi. I was interested in hearing what you guys have to say about possibly counteracting dehumanization. Can you reverse it? Can you convince people how to think differently with different propaganda, or what do you think?
All right. Thanks, Lisa. Prevention, stopping it. How do we avoid? This was my question that I kind of, why do we keep doing it? This is a different way of asking that question. How do we avoid repeating the atrocities of history, which we all look back on and say that was horrific?
Yeah. Particularly when we lose, right? That's the question I'd love to have a real definitive answer for. I have non-definitive answers. So I think there are two fronts. One is understanding our vulnerabilities. So understanding something about how we operate as human beings to try and, however imperfectly, inoculate ourselves against certain forms of propaganda that are geared towards getting us to dehumanize others.
Inoculate ourselves against propaganda.
That's right. That's right. And
how do we do that?
Well, I know that I can slip into that way of thinking. I know that I have a propensity to rank things according to higher and lower, to racialized, to essentialize. And my knowledge of those vulnerabilities helps me to resist when people talk that way. and to not let it get a foothold on me. But that's a solution that's going to apply to relatively few people.
Well, you're talking about being open-minded and receptive to different ideas and questioning your own epistemological
knowledge. Yeah, and being on... It's more than being open-minded, because I don't want to be open-minded to dehumanizing propaganda. I want to be suspicious.
Open-minded
certain
to
ways
your
of talking.
Own human frailties and
yes, exactly.
Own vulnerabilities.
No, yeah, you
that's
got
what
it
I meant.
There. Yeah. So we gotta. We need to understand that we're vulnerable.
Because none of us would all of us would like to say, if I were put in the position where I had to participate in this, or if I got, you know, we're going to go kill mm-hmm. this X group of people, I would say no, right? But yet a large
yes.
percentage of people who are loving good people got, a big percentage got caught up in that and did things that they could not undo.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So it's very easy to say, oh, I'm different from them, but... we're all different in some way.
Sure.
But we're not, unfortunately, most of us are not different in that way.
Right, because if all of us say I would never, then genocide wouldn't happen, yet it still happens on a consistent
yeah.
basis.
Second, people like you are important. The media, the press, are vital for alerting us to dehumanizing talk. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's why totalitarian governments, what do they go after? They go after the intellectuals, people like me in the universities.
Yeah.
They go after the press, and they go after the judiciary. Right? They attempt to neutralize all these forces that can work as correctives to this sort of stuff. So that's very, very, very important. That kind of vigilance and the traditions of free speech that make that possible. Now, that, of course, has a downside, which is the traditions of free speech also make dehumanizing rhetoric possible. Once people are in the dehumanizing mindset, it's, I think, extraordinarily difficult for them to get out of it. They are really caught up in it, and their forces, then psychological forces that cause them to resist. I mean, imagine what it would be like to suddenly realize you're not righteous and saving the world from evil, killing these people, but you're doing something terribly wrong.
Yeah,
it's
uh-oh.
Very, very, very hard to own up to.
It's kind of like an abusive parent who really tortures their children owning up to that and saying,
oh, yeah.
That was not
it's,
nice.
It's soul crushing.
Yeah.
The third, I think, is actually really, really important, which is it has to do with education in history. What tends to happen, and it's different from one nation to the next for historical reasons, is we tend to idealize our history, particularly if we haven't been forced to acknowledge the atrocities that our ancestors committed. Now, if a nation's been brought to its knees like Germany, then it has to own up. And the Germans have done a very good job, but even now, you know, there's right-wing extremism fomenting in Germany. Unfortunately, the United States is very, very bad at this. The students that I teach really don't understand the degree of terrorism and atrocity and horror that was handed out to Black Americans, Native Americans, and so on. That sort of consciousness is important because it tells us we're not that different. You know, it could happen here. And it's not just us, right? Nations are born in violence. That's,
it did happen here and not very long ago.
That's right. And it can happen here again, real, real easy. So that gives a kind of humility, which might provide some small protection for us in conjunction with these other things against engaging in dehumanizing mindset again. In mass.
Attacks the environment for atrocities, for division, for high conflict. You mentioned academics, attacks on academics, attacks mm-hmm. on the judicial system, and attacks on the media. I don't want to be political, but it seems like a lot of those things are happening right now.
I've predicted these things from the time and now Trump announced his candidacy. They are happening right now. I'm afraid that we're slipping into a fascist style of government. I think it's a very, very dangerous moment. I know many of your listeners will think this is overblown and alarmist. But if you actually study these matters, you see that it isn't. The regimes that ended up as horrible, totalitarian, authoritarian regimes, it didn't happen overnight. It's incremental.
Yeah, it's slow and it's insidious. And it seems like the further we go down this path, the further divided we get, the less conversation, intellectual and responsible conversations we're having about solving problems, the finger pointing, the blaming, we got to close off everything. Mm-hmm. We can't have the rapists and, infesting our country and invading our mm-hmm. country.
Exactly.
All that dialogue is alarming. And nobody ever thinks nobody would ever think that that kind of thing could happen here. But you're saying the awareness, there is hopefully an enlightened enough amount of people in our culture that wouldn't let that happen.
Well, that depends on the forces that are marshaled against those people. Right now, it's easy to be courageous and to speak. There may come a time, and I hope I'm wrong, I really do, where it's not easy. And many people, quite understandably, are not prepared to pay that sort of cost.
It is dangerous in many parts of the world to speak your mind.
It is. It is.
And it is becoming difficult to speak it without a backlash.
Yes.
And bullying and intimidation.
Yes. But we want to keep it so people can speak their mind and not just speak their mind, but engage in reasoned discourse and use the power of the vote.
All right. We're going to go back to the phones real quick, probably for our last caller. Don, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I'll keep it real short. The way to avoid dehumanizing is to take the D out of it, D-E, and put it back into the realm of humanizing. Every Bible, every religion in the world has got basically a golden rule to it, and if that gets applied long enough to make a person stop and think and reevaluate and reassess what he's saying and doing, I think that'd probably be the biggest help we've got. But I'll leave you with that and get out of the way and let you finish up. Thank you.
All right, Don, thank you very much for that. That is, I think, really a great summary of what to do. And it's simple, but it's really not that simple. It's humanize people.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, it seems...
The question is how you do this.
Consider other people as living, feeling beings whose emotions and drives are just as important as our own, regardless of skin color mm-hmm. or religion. Now, religion complicates things, right? He said the
Very
golden
much
rule,
so.
Every religion believes in its righteousness and its correctness, right? Which is part of this select chosen group.
Yeah, yeah. So the Nazi soldiers had written on their belt buckle, God is with us. Mm. Hitler said he was doing the Lord's work. People who commit atrocities are very, very often convinced that they are doing the righteous thing. And there's also another issue. Yes, treat every human being as equally important as yourself. That's fine. That's fine as an ideal. But it begs the question of who counts as a human being, right?
Well, yeah,
you may be ruling some people out.
That's what your book started with, is the that declaration from Jefferson that talked about every man is created equal, but then they had a bunch of slaves. So obviously they couldn't be men.
Yes, that's right. And he was actually quite a vicious slave master, just by the way.
Yeah, I think there was a moral disengagement for many of those at the time as far as who qualifies as human.
That's absolutely right. In fact, the examples that I use very often now in my talks are lynching examples from the late 19th, early 20th century, where it was quite that the atrocities that were committed were unimaginable. Most Americans don't have a clue about these atrocities. And it was quite clear from coverage in the press of the day that black people, particularly black men, were seen as demonic, monstrous beasts.
Yeah. I think you're right. When it gets too far, it's too late. I got so much more that I want to talk about, but I do want to just read one thing that was talking about this moral disengagement. And it's a little statement in your book. It said, "The gunner was firing away with what I can only describe as a beatific smile on his face. He was exhilarated by the squeezing of the trigger, the hammering of the gun, and the flight of his tracers rushing out into the dark shore. It struck me then, and was confirmed by him and many others later, that squeezing the trigger and releasing a hail of bullets gives an enormous pleasure and satisfaction. Those are the pleasures of combat, not in terms of the intellectual planning of the tactical and strategic chess game, but of the primal aggression and release of the orgasmic discharge." That's an intense statement about that power that takes over in times of atrocities.
Yeah, so look, when you're released from an inhibition,
yes,
there's something tremendously exhilarating about that.
You're drunk.
Yeah, but it coexists. This is very, very important. That almost manic exhilaration that sometimes people experience in combat coexists with this darker sense of guilt, which catches up to most people.
Afterwards, yes. Do you live with that that level of discrepancy in what you know to be right and what you've done?
We greatly, greatly, greatly underestimate the spiritual and psychological burdens that veterans come back with. We treat the psychiatric complications of combat as like a bad case of the flu. You know, it can be cured, and it's not that simple.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have today. Dr. Livingstone Smith, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Great questions.
It was a pleasure. Please remember, we have some resources about today's topic on our show page. That's alaskapublic.org. Click on the link to today's show. Dr. Jay Butler will be joined next week by Dr. Ira Chasnoff for a conversation about the health impacts of drug and alcohol use during pregnancy. So be sure to tune into that discussion next Wednesday, our new time, July 25th at 10 a.m., repeating at 8 on FM 91.1 Alaska Public Media. Eric Bork did our web editing for today's show. Dave Waldron was our audio engineer. Thanks for taking the time to join us today on Line One. Till next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.